But she gets the print paper. Okay.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, today is Monday, March 27th, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee.
Hello. Joint Committee on Subcommittee on Human Services, and my colleagues on the other side of the dais
want to play. Today we're going to be continuing the public hearing on Senate Bill 5526 regarding the Department of Human Services. We'll be starting our section on vocational rehabilitation. Ms. Barley, anything you want to talk about before we get started?
Madam Kutcher, just the materials are in OLIS.
Cool. Ms. Lee, Mr. Psyche, Flores, Ms. Brickman, whoever's coming up to join us. Mr. Morey, just stack stopping everybody. Cool. Flores, yours.
Chair Steiner here, we're Chair Rayfield, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. And with me at the table is Trina Lee, who's the director of our vocational rehabilitation program. Trina has been our VR director for 2 years now, and prior to that, she spent 25 years in the department and has held leadership positions in our Aging and People with Disabilities division, as well as our Self-Sufficiency division. During her tenure as the director, Trina has implemented new federal rules promulgated by the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. And while that may not sound like a very big deal, anybody who's had that experience knows that it's quite an undertaking. She's also participated in negotiations for the settlement negotiations for the Lane versus Brown lawsuit, which led to the Employment First program that Ms. Tennedy talked to you about last week. Under her leadership, our Voc Rehab division has strengthened relationships with partners and stakeholders, and they continue to provide quality services to the people we serve. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Lee.
Good morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trina Lee, and it's an honor and a pleasure to be in front of you today. I'm going to do my very best to breeze through these slides. Don't worry, I spend some time, a little bit longer time on certain slides, so don't think that if we spend a lot of time on one slide that that's going to be the cadence for all the slides. So hopefully we'll get through it in good time. Just wanted to remind you that for vocational rehabilitation, we are approaching our 100-year mark. We started in 1917 in the state of Oregon with a Smith-Hughes Act in 1917, and in year 2020, we're really looking to, that's when the VR program nationwide really got started. So 100 years prior, 1920. Let me get started. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about our mission, our goals, our objectives. I'm going to go a little deeper dive into our services, our accomplishments, our challenges, and some of our key performance measures, and then our budget. And I will be taking questions, obviously, throughout the entire presentation. So moving on to the mission. So for vocational rehabilitation, we assist Oregonians with disabilities to achieve, maintain, and advance in employment and independence. The last time I was here in front of you, we didn't have the word advance in our mission because the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act now requires us to also focus upon individuals while they're working to get to the next better job. As Director Psyche indicated, we've had some real game changers with the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, and throughout the presentation today, I'm going to be highlighting some of those major changes. We received our final regulations just August of last year, and we've been on a real dead sprint to get as much accomplished as possible. So I wanted to really quickly highlight why vocational rehabilitation matters. And this slide is relatively self-explanatory, but I want to highlight a couple of key areas. In the state of Oregon, we have over 350,000 working-age Oregonians with disabilities. However, my program ends up serving a little bit over 16,000 per year. If you take a look nationally and you look at individuals who are employed versus not employed, if you have a disability or not, 72% of those individuals of working age without a disability are working, compared to only 34.7%. Additionally, the median hour wage you'll see at the bottom of the slide is a large difference between the median wage of individuals with a disability, which is a little bit under $20,000 per year, compared to a little under $30,000 if you're not experiencing a disability. That gap is starting to narrow. However, we still have a lot of work to do. So what's been focusing us this past couple of years? We've been really focused upon having objectives, goals, and strategies to really focus our work. And I'd like to quickly highlight with you some of our external and internally facing goals and objectives. We are going to continue to support our customer experience. We want to make sure that it's empowering, effective, and efficient, and that we implement an inclusive statewide youth program. And I'm going to dive into each of these programs a little bit later in the presentation. Create and implement an employer engagement model. Some individuals may or may not recognize that for vocational rehabilitation, we have a dual customer, not only the clients that we serve, but also the businesses as well. Internally, really quickly, we are really focusing upon making sure that we have an agile and sustainable program, that we have all of our staff engaged and understand the goals of our program and working towards the same targets, and that we're managing all of these changes, and that we are also updating our business practices, and that our policy and program alignment are in check. So this slide, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on, so don't worry. This is representation of all the services that we provide, and throughout the presentation, you're going to see a small picture, like up to the right-hand side, and I'll have arrows pointing to the different areas of the pyramid. We're going to start with the very top of the pyramid, which is supported employment, and for the year 2016, and that's federal fiscal year, we've served 755 individuals. We also... Now I'm going to talk a little bit later about some of the outcomes of those individuals, but this is all individuals. Excuse me. So the supported employment is the smallest population that we serve, but it's the most significant. And what I mean by that is that these individuals really require ongoing services after we have found placement, after they've stabilized, and that they need job coaching. They may need some other job services on shoulder to shoulder. And when I take a look at the individuals that fall within this category, usually they are individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, could have a traumatic brain injury, or they have a severe and persistent mental illness. Now, that's not a requirement, of course, but just the individuals that are represented of the 755. Going down to the next layer on the triangle is the Youth Transition Program. And with the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, we are required to really focus upon the youth population. And in a few slides in the future, you're going to see how that focus has really changed the dynamics and the makeup of the individuals that we serve. The WIOA requires us to focus on individuals in school that are not even necessarily eligible for our program yet. We have pre-employment transition services because the thought is the more that you work with children in school earlier, then you may not be able to have to engage quite as much down the road. Additionally, we're working with the Education Department and also with University of Oregon for our YTP program, which is the Youth Transition Program, which has two interconnecting goals: to improve post-transition outcomes for youth with disabilities by preparing them for employment or career-related post-secondary educational training, and to increase the capacity and create system change in schools and other agencies servicing students with disabilities in transition from school to work. Even though we have served 4,000 youth, there's an estimated 25,000 students in special education and those with IEPs. And when we take a look at the individuals this last year that we have started serving for the pre-employment transition services, we have an additional 6,000 that's not represented on this chart today. But we still have a lot of work to do to get to that 25,000.
Ms. Lee. Maybe it's because it's Monday morning, mm-hmm. but I'm having a little trouble tracking between all the different numbers. Because mm-hmm. if you look back two slides, you talk about the basically 16,500 right. people who were assisted in 2016. And then you get to this slide, the pyramid slide, and you're talking about I can't quite figure out how you get to 16,000 out of this slide, and then you're talking about all the other people who are in the school system who might or might not be eligible. And I also can't tell if these are subsets of each other, because when you have a pyramid, sometimes I think of that as... So I'm a little confused, and I'm not tracking the numbers really well, and it's probably me, not you. But if I'm confused, maybe somebody else is.
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward. thank you for getting to the place of confusion, because that was my intent. So,
oh, good.
So that was
nicely done this week. Mission accomplished. I'm really pleased to hear that.
No, actually, if you add up all of those numbers, they do not come to that 16,000, and there's a reason for that. And I will get a little bit further. The independent living services is not representative in the 16,000. However, the other numbers are, and you'll see some other slides that will make it make a little bit more sense.
So there's some overlap in those three groups, those three upper sections of the pyramid, because that adds up to more than 16,000.
Correct. Correct.
Cool.
And if you still have some issues with the numbers by the time we get to near the middle of the slide deck, let me know. And that means that I just need to clarify a little bit.
Okay.
And it is Monday morning, and I probably have had just a fuzz too much coffee. So
we're
I'll
all good.
Best.
Keep going.
So moving on to the, so where was I? Youth Transition Services. I think I talked a lot about that. Let me just highlight really quickly to let you know where we're at in school districts. Currently, we have 115 school districts, which means that we are in 150 high schools, about four-fifths of the state. And remember, one of our goals is to have a statewide youth program, so we still have a little bit further to go. We are currently, we have a procurement out on the street, and we're taking RFAs, RFPs, anyway, we're taking requests for proposals through March 31st, so we're really close to the deadline out on Orpen. And then the basic services, the 13,000, is basically the other individuals that we serve. And one of the things I want to highlight about this, and I'm going to highlight several cases that we've had in the past year, but the services are really individual. So when a person comes to us, it's not as if some of the other programs where they're automatically guaranteed to get X, Y, or Z. In our program, it depends upon what that individual needs. What is their disability? What's their impediment to employment? And what type of services are going to help them get to their goals, their career goals? And that differs from person to person. So when I highlight in a few slides ahead the three different individuals, you'll see the vast differences of some of the services that we've provided. The last portion on this screen, the independent living services, this is a little unique, and vocational rehabilitation is what we call the designated state entity or the designated state unit, which means that the federal funds that go to the Centers for Independent Living and the State Independent Living Council come through us. It doesn't mean necessarily that they are within our program, but we do funnel their funds through us. And I have a couple slides in this deck that will go into a little bit more detail as to the services that they provide. But there are seven centers for independent living, and then there's a statewide independent living council. They have created a plan for independent living across Oregon. And the big thing that I want you to take away for the independent living is that they're consumer run. In other words, 51% of their staff and of their board have to be individuals with disabilities. So, and some of their key messages is nothing about us without us. And so they are definitely driving the independent living movement within Oregon. Moving on. Thank you. So this is a really quick glance at our organizational structure. And obviously I like triangles and circles. Those are my two favorite shapes. And I wanted to highlight a couple of things. You'll notice the State Rehabilitation Council kind of circles around us, along with over to the right-hand side, the State Independent Living Council. For our program, we rely very heavily upon these two entities, which are governor-appointed and required by law, to give us guidance, and I consider them both to be our thought and policy partners, especially the State Rehabilitation Council, of which I do believe that you may hear from some individuals tomorrow during the public hearing. We also, on the left-hand side of our triangle, is representative of our field structure, and my next slide will show where all of our branch offices are. However, we do have 14 branch offices, and the way that I've organized the program is to mirror the requirements of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. Let me just make sure that I've covered everything I have. Okay. Moving on, this is a picture of our field offices. We have 14 branch offices, but you'll notice that including the satellite offices, there's well over 30 offices across the state. We are 1% of the DHS budget, which I'll get into the budget numbers in a few minutes, but we're the smallest DHS program. We have 260 staff, and of those individuals, we have 142 vocational rehabilitation counselors. Our counselors, the majority of them have master degrees, and many of those individuals are certified rehabilitation counselors. So we're offering a counseling profession, a counseling practice to individuals with disabilities.
Ms. Lee, and probably a question for you and partly for Mr. Psyche. Are your folks generally co-located or separate from other DHS services that are provided in those communities, especially in some of our more rural communities?
Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward, it depends upon the location. We've had a few buildings that were standalone, and then other buildings that we are co-located with the Department of Human Services. We have some areas that we are co-located with the WorkSource Oregon. Mm-hmm. So it really depends upon the availability of space in those different communities. So it really depends. We also try to have a presence. If we're not co-located in the WorkSource, we try to make sure that we're there. However, with just the small number of staff, because many of our offices, especially in Central and Eastern Oregon, may consist of one, two, or three individuals. So pretty small.
Thank you.
This is the best part of the presentation. I'm going to introduce you to three individuals that we have served this last year that are vastly different. I'd like to introduce you to Rusty Alto. And Rusty lives in the Klamath Falls area, which is where I'm from. And he is 45 years old, and he had been a truck driver most of his life until he unfortunately came down with Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever and had some significant lasting effects due to that issue. Due to that diagnosis. So he suffers from serious liver, spleen, nervous system, heart and blood vessel damage, and that he also unfortunately has diabetes. So his impediments to employment included chronic pain, lack of stamina and endurance, concentration, work tolerance, and temperature tolerance, all of things which probably wouldn't bode well if he wanted to continue to be a truck driver. So he came into the vocational rehabilitation program, and he needed some assistance with job search and interview skills. We helped him update his resume. We also did quite a bit of benefits counseling because Rusty had gotten onto SSI, and he had made the determination that he wanted a lot more out of life than living on SSI. And so we assisted him in some services through the DMV and to assist him to continue to have his CDL and to get his physical exam. And then he started doing some other work type. He went to the community college and he started as a lab technician in the community college at Klamath Community College, and really liked working there. And this last term he helped co-teach a class, and this next term he is going to be solo teaching a class to teach other truck drivers. It was a 220-hour commercial driving course at Klamath Community College, and he is really happy. So he can pull upon all of his history and his experience in different ways. So we're really excited.
So I'm asking all the questions this morning. Other people should feel free to chime in, but how much, I know it's a little hard to know with an individual case, but roughly speaking, how much does VR spend helping someone like Rusty? He's motivated, which is always a good place to start. But over what period of time did all this take place, and how much do you think it cost to help him?
Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you for the question. Our average cost per case is usually around $3,300 to $3,600 per person. However, as I indicated before, every case is so vastly different. We did not spend that amount on this case. We actually spent, I think, maybe $1,000 or so on this case. And as for the exact length of time, I'd have to go back and take a look. I didn't notice that in the case.
Seems like a pretty good investment to me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Are you ready to move on to meet Amelia? Amelia is one of our youth transition students, and she's 19 years old, and she graduated from Rex Putnam High School. She was part of the youth transition program up there, and the real interesting thing about Amelia is that she participated in one of the first cohorts that went to Legacy Health Hospital. And Legacy Health and the youth transition program in that area, they created a very unique partnership where the transition students got to go to the hospital and tour the entire hospital with the human resources department. department, and they walked and talked them through all the different jobs within the hospital and what it was going to take to be able to land those type of jobs. And then the key attributes that that employer is looking for is what the youth transition program really focused upon. And so with Amelia, she was, like I said, was one of the first cohorts. They took it three individuals at first, and she was still going to high school at the time, and so she worked part-time in their kitchen department and eventually graduated from high school. Plus, she's completed 1 year of college so far, and she's just been promoted to a full-time job, and she's really, really excited. Now, what I failed to mention about Amelia is that her disability is a little different than Rusty's. She has difficulty in communicating with her peers, both giving and taking information. And so she needed a little bit of job coaching and some extra explanation about how to do the job, of which now she's not even requiring any job coaching whatsoever. And the services that we provided for her were a little bit different. She needed some clothing. She needed a lot of mock interviewing and resume in-person meetings and the job coaching, as well, as I mentioned. We also spent quite a bit of time with the vocational counseling with her because this is one of her first jobs. And also the team itself with the youth transition specialist, the supervisor, and Amelia had to do quite a bit of problem solving at first when she first got the job. What's interesting about Amelia is that she saved all of her money from her part-time job, bought her first car, so now she's not relying upon transportation with other people. So she's really a very good ambassador, I believe, for the youth transition program up in the Portland area.
Okay, I have yet another question. Mm-hmm. What did you do this morning? How did you recruit Legacy, and what do you guys have to do with employers to help them be? I mean, some employers might be like, well, if you can't figure this out in the second day on the job, I'm not interested in investing that kind of time and money. I think that's a little bit penny-wise and pound-foolish, personally, but you have to help coach employers to know what they're getting, right, and enter into these partnerships with them?
Absolutely. Thank you, Co-Chair Representative Steiner Hayward. I will address some of this a little bit later in the presentation, but going back to our dual customer model, it's really important that we do build that relationship with the employers, because especially when you have individuals that deal with significant disabilities, it may behoove that individual to be able to go into what we used to call a job carve, but more a specialized or customized type of employment. And the only way you're going to know how to do that is if you have that experience.
Great. Representative Gilbert?
Yeah.
And then Senator Winters, and then Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair. Just speaking from firsthand experience, my medical group has participated in this program, and you guys have done a great job in providing that transition and training and ongoing mentorship, and it's been enormously successful.
That's great. Senator Winters?
Thank you. How did Amelia come to you in the first place? Who referred her to you?
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, actually, I need to go in and do a little bit more detail to verify, but she was part of the youth transition program within the high school. So I believe because of the classes that she was taking, but I can certainly verify that.
Yeah. Well, follow up. So do you have a program with the various high schools in the metropolitan Portland area or across the state? And if you do in all parts of the state or portions of the state, but how do the transitional program, is it working just in Portland?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, thank you for the question. We're not completely statewide yet. We're about 4/5 across all the state in the different high schools. I have some specifics around the Portland area in my notes, so let me find them really quickly and I can tell you kind of where we're at in the Portland area. Of the top 20 largest school districts in the state, there's only 4 that's not part of youth transition program. Currently, those 4 are Beaverton, David Douglas, Gresham, Barlow, and Lake Oswego, which are all in the Portland area. But outside of those 4 areas, they do have youth transition programs. In the areas that they don't have youth transition programs, we are still providing some services through our transition network facilitators, which are individuals that we share with the education department, and they are able to go and help students, and they can always be referred directly to vocational rehabilitation as well. But our ultimate goal is to get into every high school.
Follow up, because is it the student counselors that refer the students to you, teachers, administration, but how do you actually, who does the referral? And then what are the standards that they have to have in order to actually refer the students?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, thank you for the question. Basically, the referral source can be all the above. And so it can be parents, it can be self-referred. If they're currently in special education or if they have an IEP, certainly the referral portion can be within that as well.
I can get the nexus with IEP, you know, very quickly. What I can't get is if it's just an open door, how are you able to screen and assess?
Co-Chair, Senator Winters, thank you again for the question. So individuals still have to have a disability. And so if they're not participating in special education or have an IEP, then there would be, especially if they wanted to have not the pre-employment transition services, but the actual services that are on that chart, would have to have a verifiable disability. They'd have to have impediments to employment. And that's what our vocational rehabilitation counselors determine. So, and I have some slides in the part of the deck going through the process that I think will help you. If not, let me know, and I'd be happy to sit down and have a conversation.
Thank you.
Okay?
Representative Molstrom.
Senator Winters, ask my questions.
I love it when my community say.
Just out of curiosity, those are big school districts. Why are they not? Do you have a sense of why they don't participate?
Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward and members of the committee, there's a long history with the Youth Transition Program. It's been in Oregon for a long period of time. And honestly, because I haven't been here as long, I do not know quite all the history, but I can certainly bring that information forward.
I'd like a little follow-up, because those are big districts that one of which is five-sixths of my district is in the Beaverton School District. I'm kind of curious whether those kids are getting the kinds of services that they deserve to be successful that you all could be providing, or whether they're doing them some other way.
Well, you know, it's not all the districts have embraced all the needs that with IEP.
Yes, I understand that. That's why I'm a little worried about this, and it's a conversation I can have with Superintendent Grotting if I need to. So
I'd be happy to follow up and bring our youth transition coordinator, who has been involved with the program for 8 or 9 years, so he has all the history.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you. Representative Alonso Leon.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just along the lines of this question, I often think about our GED students, right? We have 16 to 60-year-olds, and those students who left school for whatever reason often don't get the assessments done. And so I just want to make sure that that the state is really promoting this program to all students, including our GED students, to make sure that they know about these services, whether it's in a nonprofit organization, whether it's at a church, wherever they offer prep and instruction on GED, in addition to obviously the high schools or the school systems which we just talked about. How are you all promoting this is a question that Senator Winters asked. And for me, since I was the former GED administrator, I know that the GED testing service company at a national level have an accommodations department that essentially assesses, or not assesses, but takes assessments, takes all the information from students to help with accommodations. But I'm just wanting to make sure that all of our students all over the state, regardless of whether they are in our education system or are, you know, working on earning their GED, that they all know about the service.
Co-chairs and Representative Alonso Leon, thank you for the question. And it's something that we continue to strive for. We're not completely statewide. However, we do have a commitment to try to get to all of the individuals with disabilities from the age of 16 up to 25, regardless if they're in the school systems or not. We've had some opportunity to work with the state hospital, which has a non-traditional type school within the state hospital as well. We're also working with the tribes as well. And so we're trying and working with different ESD districts to really have as much penetration as we possibly can. And so, but yet I recognize we are not 100% at all. However, we're certainly striving to do so. If there's an individual or a specific population that you need us to reach out to, please let us know. We'd be happy to do that. We do have, you saw the map, counselors all over Oregon, and many of those counselors go directly to or within their communities. They know their communities well, and they're certainly trying to build those relationships as much as possible.
Follow up Chair, so yes, thank you for that question. So the GED program received $2 million in 2015. $1.6 million of that is actually meant to go back into the education system, meaning those programs that offer prep and instruction for GED students. I think that I left right before during the RFP process, but right before they selected the programs that were going to be getting funded. Mm-hmm. So I think they selected 16 programs. I could be wrong, but reach out to the HEC because the GED program is under the purview of the HEC. And so they've identified those particular programs already to receive funding. So those would be great places for you to go and promote these particular programs, because I want to make sure that everybody knows about these services and that we're connecting them.
Co-chairs and Representative Alonzo Leon, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned the word HEC the acronym HEC, because we are already attached to them in the workforce system. We're both mandatory partners that have to be at the table at the workforce, both at the state level and we have multiple levels that we're sitting in, and we all have established the relationships. But a lot of it is getting to know the different services that each provide and whatnot. So my deputy's in the back of the room, and he's the one that actually sits on many of those councils, and I know he's making notes about what you're talking about today. So we'll make sure that we follow up and do so.
Thank you.
Okay. You're good?
So let me do you have one more question?
You have a good question.
I'm going to get back to budget because the program's good. But what I'd like to know is if you've done an assessment of what it's costing you per student. Voc Rehab has always had the reputation of probably being one of the better agencies, in my view. That RAN and ACSI meets its overall goals and objectives as far as the work that it does and in placing individuals into work. So on this one, what is your cost? Have you done an analysis of your cost for students that you serve?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, thank you for the question. Unfortunately, I did not bring that detail with me today. However, I would be happy to follow up.
It would be very helpful for us to know that.
Yeah, we do track by student, and so we can certainly give you that information.
So that begs a really interesting question, potentially, which is, have you also tracked your outcomes? And given that you have four large school districts that don't use youth transition program, do you have a way of finding a case control, as it were, to figure out whether the kids who are in who are analogous to the ones you're serving but are in districts that don't participate in youth transitions are having different outcomes in terms of employment or ongoing education? Because you can have the smallest costs in the world, and it doesn't matter if you're not getting great outcomes.
Right.
You can have much larger costs, and if you're getting really substantial outcomes in the long term, give people much more independence and autonomy, mm-hmm. and save the state money, we're much more willing to invest.
Right.
So the conversation we're having in this committee is about evidence, and I'd love to see some of the evidence around the successes of your program compared to, or more accurately, the successes of people who participate in your program compared to those who don't, who are analogous to those who do.
Co-chairs and Senator Steiner Hayward, specifically, we're still in the early stages of gathering information from the school districts, especially around the pre-employment transition services, because it's a new requirement. However, since we've had youth transition programs, we do have some data. But as for the longitudinal data that you're talking about and looking at the evidence base, I didn't bring any of that information. But when we meet with, when I bring Keith Ozels with me, we can have that conversation, and I can find what we've done so far today. We do try to take a look at, for all the different individuals that we serve, and we look at successes across the state. We look at the amount that we're spending. We look at the different disability types. And so we really have tried to analyze as much as possible, but there is some limitations to the data that we have. But I'd be happy to share with you what we have.
Yeah,
think that I and perhaps others in the committee would be very interested. Mm-hmm. We can talk a little bit offline about that. Maybe you can set up a time to come and visit with me a little bit and bring whoever else you think would make the most sense.
That would be great.
Thank you, Ms. Lee.
So let me introduce you to Nick. This is a really great story, and had I had only a chance to talk about one, I would have focused upon Nick because it's pretty touching. So Nick is a 36-year-old individual who is deaf. He has profound hearing loss in both ears. And we've been working with Nick off and on since he was in high school, and he struggled in trying to fit in with different employers because his ability to communicate with individuals with hearing was challenged, and also to fit in. And so he is an experienced welder, and eventually we were able to connect him with CellMed Incorporated, which is in the Albany area, and they are one of the leading manufacturers, let me look at my notes here, for titanium castings and machine parts in the aerospace industry. But what is really exciting about this organization, this company, is that they place great value on diversity, safety, and teamwork. And so you see things like the welders and the engineers interacting with each other, and they also bring all the employees together on a pretty consistent basis and talk about the company's processes and procedures. When we first connected Nick with CellMed, we were providing interpreters, and now the company is doing that on their own, so they see the value of being able to have Nick be part of their team. What's also interesting is that besides the interpretive services, we assisted him with clothing, transportation. We also helped him with some rehabilitation technology. But CellMed has taken some responsibility of their own as well, because in their production floor, not only have they set up alarms auditorily, which is the standard, but also visually. And so they're able to assist both those individuals that are hearing impaired, but also those that do have hearing on their floor, which has been really helpful. What's interesting about Nick is that he's become an ambassador, and he's now going back to the School of the Deaf to really promote many of the trades. And his goal is to try to convince as many students with deafness to come to work for this organization, because he would like to be a lead. In fact, and I'll quote him, he says, "I love it here. In fact, I would like to be a lead in a team in the future. If more deaf employees were hired, I would welcome the chance to supervise them. I hope to retire from CellMed someday." So, I mean, such a touching story of an individual who really was connected with an employer that saw the value and of the teamwork. And we've been able to not provide the ongoing services now. The employer has picked those costs up, and they're definitely getting a lot of bang for their buck. So he's very happy. Okay, now I'm going to start flying through some of these. Lots of numbers, and I'll do my best to try to not confuse everybody. So this is a list. This slide represents individuals that we've served since federal fiscal year 2010 through this last federal fiscal year. And if you look up at the top, the triangle, this is the top three layers of the triangle: supported employment, youth transition, and then also the basic services. And you notice that our numbers have increased in our youth. And just last year, our number of adults have started to climb again as well. We've remained relatively flat. We have a capped grant, and so we draw down as much federal fund as we possibly can. However, we are experiencing some growth as much as possible. The next slide I'm extremely proud of. This highlights some very specific outcomes. On the upper left-hand corner, you'll see our employment outcomes, which we've closed with rehabilitation. And in order to get to that stage, a person has to have, not only do they have to have a job, but they have to have a job that fits within their employment goal, and they have to be in that job for at least a 90-day period of time and be stabilized. And from other hearings, these jobs are all minimum wage or above, so we do not count any sub-minimum wage jobs as a rehabilitation. And you'll see over to the right the supported employment. These are actual jobs within supported employment. Now, that 663 number is a subset of the 2,975. So all of those numbers are included in the left-hand chart. But you can see specifically, and I think because of the Employment First Initiative and the Lane versus Brown lawsuit, we've really emphasized working with the IDD population in supported employment. And I really believe that's some of the growth that we've seen, which has been really astronomical this last couple of years. So I'm pretty excited.
So just to be clear really quickly, I get that the people in the red column support employment are subsets mm-hmm. of the blue ones. Mm-hmm. Are the blue ones unique individuals? Are those individuals per year? Or are those, you know, somebody who was counted in 2013 also counted in 2016?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you for the question. So, first of all, they are unique individuals. However, a person can come back and have multiple cases. So, because remember, we now focus upon advancement. So, if they got a job for a period of time and then want to advance in 2 to 3 years, they may be counted in individual years. However, they were individual cases.
Got it. Thank you.
The youth transition, these are actual placements as well. And then the bottom right-hand side is the rehabilitation rate. So that's the percentage of individuals that were actually rehabilitated compared to those that went into plan. And even though, and this is one of the areas, and I'm going to touch upon this in a few slides, the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, before WIOA, our standard was the rehabilitation rate all across the nation. And the feds, their standard for us was right at about 58%. So we have been above 58% for quite a long period of time. Now the rehab rate isn't our measuring stick. We have six different performance measures, which I'm going to get into in a few other slides. But the rehabilitation rate, which also ties to our KPM, which I'll talk about at the end of the slide deck, is still a really good indicator of how we're doing. So even though it may not be our measurement per se, I think it's a really good way to continue to see from a very high level how we're doing. Okay. I have some demographic slides. The next three slides I'm going to talk about from looking at individuals. Again, this is from the top three layers of the pyramid. These are the individuals, the different disability types that we serve. And these numbers obviously change from year to year because it depends upon the individuals that come into our door. But this last year in 2016, and this is both for youth and for adults, our highest disability type was cognitive impairment, which would include intellectual disability. Specific learning disabilities, autism, attention deficit disorder, etc. The second was psychosocial impairments, which is a wide range of maladaptive disorders, for example, mental illness or things that are influenced by their life experience. So some examples would be depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, substance abuse, generalized anxiety, PTSD, etc. The third is physical impairments at 13%. And there, you'll notice on here there's a physical impairment and also an orthopedic impairment. And the difference between the two is that one is in regards to the disability of movement. So if your movement is being impaired, then you would fall into the orthopedic impairment compared to the other physical disabilities. And then, of course, when you're looking at deaf or blindness, Commissioner for the Blind, I know they were here last week, we do some co-case management on certain cases, especially for individuals that may have physical disabilities as well. However, there are individuals that don't necessarily qualify for their services, and so they end up, we serve them. The next slide is the demographics of gender and age, and I find it really interesting. I was practicing my presentation to my daughter yesterday, and she's like, oh, Mom, my age group is the top age group, which is 20 to 29, and I said, oh, yeah, and my age group is the second. Mm-hmm. The demographics of who we serve obviously changed from year to year, but it's pretty interesting that the distribution, except for when you get under 16 or over 70, is relatively even all the way around, which is kind of interesting. And finally, and Representative Alonzo Leon will appreciate this one, we have the race-ethnicity slide, and I just want to say that when we compare the demographics of Oregon to the individuals that we serve, we're relatively close. And there's a couple of areas that we are short in, and one of them being the American Indian and Alaskan Native. Unfortunately, the population is about 2.3%, and we served about 1.7% of the individuals that we served. And I contribute that mainly because there are multiple tribes that have their own rehabilitation services or tribal VR, and so they serve their tribal members first. Now, sometimes we do co-serve them, but there are areas of the state, and not all tribes have VR programs. The other area that has just dipped this year, and I really don't know why yet, and we're going to have to do a little bit deeper dive, is the Asian community. We're a little bit low in the Asian community, so we're going to be reaching out, hopefully have those conversations. We've focused extremely hard with the Hispanic and Latino population as we have connections with the Latino Connection, and they've really helped us try to look at our services to make sure that they are very culturally specific and whatnot. So I'm very proud to say that we are serving Oregonians as best that we possibly can. So moving on to the process, this slide has a ton of information, and I'm not going to read through it specifically, but I wanted to show you that, highlight a couple of things. So this is in the year 2016. We took over 8,000 applications, and then we determined 7,500 eligibilities. And I wanted to make sure that you recognize that this is not a cohort model. So it wasn't of those 8,000 that we determined 7,500, because our timelines can kind of move around. For example, when a person comes in, we have 60 days to determine their eligibility, and then once they've been determined eligible, we have 90 days to get them into plan. I know that seems like a very long time, but I wanted to highlight that the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act actually required us to shrink the amount of time to get people into plan. It used to be 180 days. We're doing relatively well in that. We still have some room to grow. We do determine people within 60 days. We're in the high 90%. But when it comes to getting people into plan, we have some more work to do. And then once a person, as I mentioned earlier, obtain a job, successful employment, they exit the program. And here's a list of those key performance measures from the feds. We now have to look at, instead of the rehabilitation rate, we have to take a look at, once a person has left our program, are they still employed the second and fourth quarter after they've exited the program? Unfortunately, we don't have the data for 2016 yet, but looking at 2015 data, the second quarter retention rate was about 56%. And then looking at the fourth quarter retention rate in 2015 was about 54%. So we're expecting numbers very similar to that for 2016. And we don't have targets yet set for this. The feds for the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act are giving us 2 years to set those standards.
What co-chair three gals said it's over.
No, I just had a quick question. So there was 56% retention in the second quarter and then 54% in the fourth quarter. Is that 54% of the 56 in the second quarter or 54% of the total?
Co-chair, Representative Rayfield, excellent question. It is the now I've forgotten if you said further. So it is. So you take a look at all the individuals that exited the program, and then you look at two quarters, and then you look at four quarters. So it's not a percentage of the second quarter; it's a percentage of your original individuals that left.
So you only lost 2%.
Correct.
Between the second and fourth quarter.
We did. You know, in looking at this information in this way, it's really interesting because it captures some work that the rehabilitation rate didn't capture. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we have rehabilitation counselors and they're doing a lot of work, but sometimes people, their lives, they're just not able to work yet. But yet down the road, they do use the skills that they've learned or the opportunities that they've had. And so there is a small percentage of individuals that even though they didn't leave our program with a job, in the second or fourth quarter, they actually have a job by then. So by capturing it this way, it allows us to pick up and to show that body of work.
Yeah. That's interesting. And then we'll follow up.
Please.
What and so obviously it's really interesting you're kind of tracking some of the folks, but for the if you were to track the 44% of the in that second quarter, you know, how many of those are the ones that transition to a job in the fourth quarter, or what happens to those other subset of people?
Co-Chair Representative Rayfield, that's an excellent question, and we haven't quite teased some of that information out yet. Once we get the 2016 data, we're going to be taking a look at many of those different pieces, because when we added advancement to our mission, that's new to us. And before, it was once a person was closed, then we were pretty much done unless they came back through our doors. And so we're really trying to think about how do we continue to provide services or touch base with individuals. And there's gold in that information that you're looking at as to what happened with those individuals and if there's any way that we could have assisted them. And a little bit later in the slides, when I talk about challenges, I'm going to introduce the order of selection to you and some of the decisions that we've made that's going to potentially help with some of that. So anyway, we'll get there. I don't have the information today, but that's an excellent idea. And then, and I don't have information on the credential and skill gain, but in fact, our computer system is being updated as we speak from our vendor to be able to start capturing that information. But in the future, we'll be able to say, as you know, as a performance measures, how many skills and how much education did individuals gain while they were with us. So I'm looking forward to being able to report to that in the future. And then, of course, employer satisfaction is something that the feds are still trying to figure out, and besides just looking at if a person is still with the same employer in the second and fourth quarter is all, and I need to speed up. So, all right, moving on. Centers for Independent Living. Here is the slide of all the centers where they are located in Oregon, and here's the five independent living core services that they provide. I also wanted to remind folks that the centers also provide work incentive. They have a work incentive network, which means benefits counseling. So if a person is on Social Security or SSI, they can call and get some information about what would happen if they go back to work, what happens to their benefits. And so we, the VR, we contract with the centers to be able to do that work. So I'll fly through these pretty quickly. Here's a list of the different services that we provide to employers. This is not an all-inclusive list because, as I highlighted with the individuals that we serve, employers are also very individual as well. But we've had some really good experience with things like live resumes and meeting business. But we really wanted to provide as much training and support as possible and really focus upon diversity, inclusion, and consultation around the disability awareness, the ADA. And for those federal contractors, we can assist them with their 503 compliance. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier in the presentation, we are part of the workforce system. WIOA requires us to be at the table both at the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and also the local development boards. And so our goal of being on those boards is to make sure that we're creating access and expanding capacity, and we want to be a resource. Okay. Accomplishments for 2015. Some of this information I've already covered, but we really took a look at and created our goals and objectives, and I modeled our structure around WIOA, but also around our goals and objectives. And as Director Psyche said in the very beginning of my introduction, I've taken to heart focusing upon our relationships with our partnerships with the State Rehab Council and the State Independent Living Council. We're currently working on a comprehensive statewide needs assessment. We're required by federal law to do so every 3 years, and we're in the middle of that right now. We're hoping to wrap up that work about September, and we're also partnering with the Commission for the Blind because we wanted to make sure that we had a very comprehensive look of individuals with disabilities all across Oregon and their needs. And this is just highlighting some of the key things that we've already talked about of the individuals that we serve, the rehabs that we obtained. And I wanted to just highlight two items that Lilia Tennedy didn't cover about the Lane versus Brown. Specifically, we had a goal of 130 jobs for individuals that were in a sheltered workshop. And last year, we actually landed 143 jobs, so we exceeded that standard. And then for youth that are that were eligible, we had a goal of 50% of those youth would get a plan, and we actually well exceeded that with 80% this last year. So we're on our way, and so far our numbers look really good for this year as well. So moving on to the challenges for 2017-19, we know that at some point we're expecting, I'm assuming that RSA is going to be here in the fall. When RSA started, when they were doing their monitoring visits, they stopped with Oregon. They got through Commission for the Blind. They didn't issue their report, but they had not started yet with the general agency, which is the VR agency. And so we're expecting to be near the front of the line. So we are doing our best to get prepared. They have issued a couple of technical assistance guides. The first guide was about 60-some pages, and we are working through it diligently, answering all the questions. The second guide came out, and it's well over 100 pages, and so we have a lot more work to do to be able to show a lot of not only what we're doing, but how we've implemented WIOA. So one of the challenges, because we still have more work to do when it comes to implementation of WIOA, and I didn't go into in-depth detail of some of those requirements, but we do have additional requirements around those entities that have those 14C certificates for subminimum wage. We're required, and I know that Representative Leon, I watched the earlier presentation. There was concerns about subminimum wage, and I wanted to let the committee know that VR has a responsibility to go out and do some career counseling information and referral to all of those participants that are currently not making minimum wage, to let them know what their options are. And for youth, we have to do it every 6 months. So the feds are putting in some safety nets around individuals. So just FYI, if you need some more information, I'd be happy to provide that. The other piece is the order of selection. We're currently not in an order of selection, but if our funding or if our staff or if our capacity is reduced, then we're to a place that we don't have much cushion. And if we have to end up going to an order, it basically means that we have waiting lists. And what we have made some decisions, and we've not decided that we want to go into an order, we have to invoke at this point. But each year we have to take a look at the funding that we have and our capacity, and we have to ensure to the feds if we have the ability to serve people for the next year. And so what we've decided, that if we do have to invoke the order, we've decided, because WIOA allows it, that if a person is at risk of losing their job, and we can have them be exempt from the order of selection, because we'd like to provide a little bit of services so that way they don't lose their job and then have to go all the way through the entire process. We've also changed, we're going to be going down to 3 categories compared to 4, which mirrors and matches the federal reporting requirements and also the federal guidelines. And but we are doing some contingency planning. It's my, you know, I like to be prepared. And so if we have to go into an order, we're creating a playbook, so to speak, so that way we know what needs to happen first, second, et cetera, along with the messaging strategies, and all. Hopefully the work will be mostly done. So I have to apologize because I somehow omitted a budget slide, and I have budget people around me, so I have given some major apologies. But each of the programs was asked to show the entire DHS budget and then pull out the slice to say where we are. That's the slide I forgot. So I know we're 1%. So the next director, next presentation, if you could just take a look at that slide, you go, oh yeah, there's VR, they're 1%. So the next 3 slides are the budget slides I did remember to put in, this one highlights, you'll see that 2% of our budget in total are for the SILS and the Centers for Independent Living and the State Independent Living Council, and then our program delivery and design is about 51% of our budget, and our basic rehabilitation services is about 47% of the budget. The next donut slide shows the federal fund type. We are at about 74% federally matched, so that's 24% general fund, and we do have a 2% of other funds that come in. The next slide shows the direct payments of services, and I just wanted to highlight that the way our program is designed, we do not provide payments directly to the people that we serve, to our consumers. So you'll see that most of the payments fall to the providers and vendors and then to our actual service delivery system, because we do have a counseling practice. The next slide is our key performance measure, which is tied to the rehabilitation rate. And if you remember on that, the previous slide, the numbers are a little bit different than another slide, and there's reasons for that. It's the look back period, and what qualifies under the KPM is a little bit different than what we report to the feds, but it's relatively close, and it is at 62% for this last year. And finally, getting there. So I just wanted to remind you that, you know, our mission is to assist Oregonians with disabilities to maintain, advance, and achieve employment and independence, that we are part of the workforce system. We have a dual customer model. We've made some dynamic changes to the program because of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, and that we've increased our performance measures along the line. So I really thank you for the opportunity and the questions today, and I look forward to the follow-up questions. It's been an honor.
Great. Thank you very much. Before we get to Ms. Brickman, any other questions from the committee? Are you talking to Naaman Frickman?
Not today.
Not today.
I will be prepared to do my presentation after the agency said all of it.
Okay, I didn't know if you wanted to do it. No. Okay, cool. Representative Hayden.
Just a quick question on Nick. It said the future goals. Were those provided by him or by you? And the reason I'm asking is it's a quite a unique play on words to say that he wants to lead the team of individuals. Since he's in welding, that's a welding term.
Co-chairs and Representative Hayden, unfortunately, I don't know Nick personally, and I was just reading his case, and so, but I can tell you, though, that our practice, whenever they set goals, it's a conversation with the consumer and also the counselor, so the goals aren't chosen for him, it'll be chosen with him. Mm-hmm. But that's a great play on words, I agree.
It's a unique play on words there. Anyway.
Good. Any other questions for Ms. Lee or anybody else? Okay, then, Ms. Byerly, any business, other business of the committee?
No, I just want to remind you that tomorrow will be public testimony on aging people with disabilities, intellectual and developmental disabilities, and VR programs, so I expect we'll have a lot of activity in the room. So be ready for that. And Wednesday, we do not have a meeting scheduled, and then Thursday, we'll be back with self-sufficiency, and the materials for Thursday have been posted in the office.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Kocher, anything else? Cool. Then we're adjourned.